listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Soul Second Hour. This is Ralph Kermit Winroad the Second, coming live out of Alaska, and Mark Mays out of Oklahoma. Is our caller still on hold, or? I guess not.
Mark in Texas, are you there?
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
I guess not.
Yeah, I'm here, Ralph.
That's going to be a pickle.
I think he's still there, Ralph.
Indians, the Alaska Natives, they were declared back in the 1920s to be citizens of the United States. Congress just made it up. And they have special rights. So why is a citizen of the United States have special rights if I'm Alaska Native? Let's see, in Alaska, I can go fishing with fish wheels in certain places where Paleface can't. I can go pick up ivory over in Dillingham off the ocean. Paleface can't. I can go out and kill a moose out of season for potlatch if somebody dies. Paleface can't, but we're all citizens of the United States. Now, what am I missing here, Mark?
Well, it's all about jurisdiction and your citizenship. What is your status?
You think?
Yeah,
oh, she's still on hold. Are you still there?
Mark in Texas,
I'm here.
I believe, is still there, right? There he is.
Oh.
Mark, can you hear us?
Actually, this is Keith in Montana.
Oh, our mistake. So, Keith in Montana.
Yeah, this is Keith with Perception Management. Anyway, hey,
okay,
I wanted to... Well, actually, the question is a statement, Ralph. Here on the reservation here in Montana here, they've got billboards going up here talking about tribal tyranny, but this is because the tribes are being assigned over to this New World Order global thing here. But I wanted to relate an incident here that the tribe was to take possession of Kerr Dam up here, of which they did, but they still retain the vehicles here for Mission Valley Power that have government plates on it. And during a meeting, the tribe was trying to assert power over all waters on the reservation here, and they even talking about putting meters on our private wells. But anyway, during the meeting there, it was brought up that the tribe, even though they thought they were sovereign, was actually controlled by the BIA, and that these lands were all in tribal trust, which actually meant that the government owned them. Anyway, during that meeting, that pissed, and this was posed by a journalist that was up there, and this pissed the tribe off so much that they closed the public meeting, and they went into a private session over it. But back to this tribal tyranny thing, a lot of the tribal members are waking up that their reservations are actually being sold from, basically sold out from underneath them, and this probably goes along with that 2030 agenda of the Klaus Schwab clan about by 2030 you'll own nothing and be happy. And even the reservations, if you notice all these wars and stuff, there are race and nationality borders, and this is to form their new world government. And so I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Well, I tell you what, see, this is a big pickle. When I was up in Wyoming, I lived in the western Wyoming. I worked at Jim Bridger Powerhouse. And that's the largest powerhouse. It was a 1,500 megawatts when I was there. The power was being shipped back to Oregon, Washington, California, because they love the power with no coal. And coal is clean, by the way, because I worked 20 years in the system. And I got to make a comment, and then we'll get back to Texas. The thing about coal-fired power plants, they have something called spinning reserve, because the load varies a lot. These windmill things, they can't do that. Solar power can't do that. You would have a 500 megawatt generator online, maybe only putting out 200 megawatts, but it's got spinning reserve of, say, 300 megawatts. They used to use this all the time when I was in the power industry. Somebody loses power, you can crank up 300 more megawatts because you got the turbine there. You just give it more steam, change the part on the generator, the field on it, and you can get up to 300 megawatts. It's called spinning reserve. Now, I don't know what was going on in Texas. I heard they have an independent grid. I don't know. Natural gas lines don't freeze. And if they had if they had generators that weren't winterized and they were believing this global nonsense, I saw something. I don't know what's wrong with your legislature. What can I say? But I can tell you one thing: coal works. Coal's cheap, and we have hundreds of years of it. And it's called spinning reserve. They use scrubbers on them. They use SO3 injection. They use precipitators. I worked in them. I have firsthand knowledge. And the amount of pollution that coal puts in the air is minuscule compared. It has nothing to do with what's going on in the world. Volcanoes do more damage when one of those goes off. But we got to make it be 100% clean. Wait a minute. If it's... I'm breathing. I'm putting pollution in the air. My car is putting pollution in the air. So what do? We're just going to, we'll go to electric cars. And how's that power going to get generated? Oh, yeah, right. Have we lost our minds? I don't know.
Well, a lot of this, Ralph, is to basically kill the U.S. economy to, as Christine Lagarde mentioned, is to move the IMF over to China and then start bilking the Chinese.
It's to bring down our country. We're putting small businesses out of business, but Walmart and all them, hey, I could just wander around in there up in Alaska with no mask, but of course, Alaska, we're not quite so bad with the mask. I don't know, Anchorage was using a mask. The masks don't work. They don't do anything, but it's a lie. COVID-19 is a lie. We don't have any flu, but we have COVID-19. It's just, where does it end? The truth. We never hear the truth. It's never. Why these people buy into this stuff. It's frustrating.
Well, Ralph, today,
America, as it stands, it will not last 2 years under Biden. I guarantee you. There's no way.
Yeah, Ralph, I was going to add this COVID variant is just like the 9/11 terror alerts, where you had the amber, the red, and this is just as it is to keep people in constant fear. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that on the up there about the reservation, because I live on one here in Montana. But anyway, you take care, and we'll talk to you later, and I'll listen to the rest of your show, okay?
Sure. Well, this native thing is a big issue. Like I say, I see it up here in Alaska, just like in Dillingham. If you're native, oh, the feds pay your taxes. If you're pale faced, they don't. What's going on here? We go to this one case, which is amazing. There's quite a few of them, but this is an amazing case. This is 1879, and it's called Ex Parte Virginia. And it covers a lot of issues that are going on today. And I'm just going to cover the main parts of this thing, because you just can't make it up. It says, we're talking about these 13th and 14th Amendments. It says, it secures to all persons their civil rights upon the same terms, but it leaves political rights, or such as arise from the form of government and its administration as they stood previous to its adoption. It has no more reference to them than it has to social rights and duties, which do not rest upon any positive law, though they are more potential in controlling the intercourse of individuals. How about those apples? Social rights. Social rights is not political, is not nothing positive law. It's called identity politics. It means if you ain't like me and you don't agree, you're a racist. That's social rights. There is no such thing as social justice, social rights. It does not exist in the law. They go on. In the consideration of the questions growing out of these amendments, much confusion has arisen from the failure to distinguish between civil and political rights of citizens. Civil rights are absolute and personal. Political rights, on the other hand, are conditioned and dependent upon the discretion of the elective and the appointing power, whether that be the people acting through their ballot or one of the departments of their government. The civil rights of an individual are never to be withheld and may be always judicially enforced. The political rights which he may enjoy, such as holding office and discharging the public trust, are qualified because their possession depends upon the fitness to be adjudged by those whom society has clothed with the elective authority. 13th and 14th Amendments were designed to secure civil rights of all persons of every race, color, and condition, but they left the states to determine to whom the possession of the political powers should be entrusted. This is manifest from the fact that when it was desired to confer political power upon the newly made citizens of the states, as was done by inhibiting the denial of them of suffrage on account of race, color, and previous condition of servitude, a new amendment was required. And does it get any clearer than that? I got cases saying that the 15th Amendment, everybody is protected on the right to vote. What is voting? It's the right to show up at the building and not be intimidated by anybody. But what's called the right of suffrage, the right of the elective franchise, is only if you are a citizen of one of the several states, domiciled in one of the several states. You have to have a domicile, and then you are a citizen of that state if you've been there 30 days or 60 days, whatever the election laws are. This is the biggest con in the world. The National Voter Registration Act is only for citizens of the United States, which the Supreme Court says has no elective franchise, no right of suffrage. And further, it says it's only for federal offices. They define state means state of the United States. The subject is state of the United States is the object. And the District of Columbia. They are tied together with a conjunction, which means it's an and. We'll use English. That's the type of elections, and it says it's only for federal offices. There are no elections for state offices. And I have a 185 ALR, 155, that says, oh, you can have elections for state offices, but nobody does. Because everybody loves civil rights. And, of course, the question that arises with a little bit of simple logic, if we, the people, as citizens of one of the several states, do not have elective franchise and suffrage, who is in charge? Guess what? They print it. I got 110 cases I put into the public record. United States of America is a sovereign body politic. United States of America is a sovereign body politic. Now, we got all kinds of Supreme Court cases. It says we, the people, are the sovereigns with a limited delegation of power through our Constitution. Well, then how can that exist? How could it be United States of America is a sovereign body politic? I got it down to the parties, the cases, all that. And I put it into public record so I could use it. So how does that work? It's easy. Don't you see it? This case that I researched out for the Moonies, it's 14,000 words, a 7,000 words, a 998-page appendix, and the en banc goes through the complete overthrow of our republic. And I found two cases. I didn't have them initially. Let me see if I could find them so I could quote them all. I found two cases, and I didn't have them initially because it takes time to find this stuff. Because the bottom line is, let me find it here in just a minute. I will put in judicial power of a district court. Now, what they did is, they couldn't have a citizen of the United States in an Article III court. It doesn't have any standing. So now what are we going to do? What are we going to do if you can't have a constitutional court and everybody thinks they're a citizen of the United States? Is that not a problem?
Well, Ralph, explain what the difference is between an Article III court and whatever other type of court a person might get wrangled into. What is it, usually an Article I court, Article II?
Okay, I'm going to get down to the definitions here. The big difference is that in a... Let me get down to the. I've got to find the cases here.
And while you're looking at
okay,
that, we've got
in an Article III court. There's got to be a real controversy with facts and law, and it's only in law or in equity. So there's got to be the common law type stuff or equity where there's no law to deal with it, and we go into equity. Now. Okay, now what they did is they had to do away with that because it doesn't have any standing. And standing means there's no real controversy going on because this is the problem they run into when the regulations. All regulations can't go in an Article III court. This is another thing. So what they did is They created a new court called United States District Court in 1948, and they renamed it. The constitutional one is District Court of the United States. It's got to be there. They just put it into the closet, and they created a new one. But here's the key. The Article 3 says judicial power. Judicial power, legislative power, executive power are strictly limited to governments. You and I don't have that. We have rights. We do not have judicial power. So the Article 3 says judicial power of the United States, on the end of that, of the United States. So it's judicial power of what government? United States. Okay? And we had a government of the United States. That's established in the Constitution. So we have judicial power of what government? So then we have, in 1948, we renamed the court, United States District Court, instead of District Court of the United States. And we created something called judicial power of a district court. Well, my question was, because I was reading Cruz's book out of Texas, where we're one vote away, and he goes into that judicial power. How can we have judicial power of a district court? Is the district court a government? I don't think so. And I finally found these two cases. And it says the district court is a tribunal created by Congress under the power given to Congress or Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9. That makes it legislative. It's under Article 1. Okay?
So you're saying that's basically an administrative court then?
That's all it is. And then it goes on to say, it confirms, it's the end here that it's 132. But then it says, goes on, and it says the power of a district court, judicial power of a district court may be exercised by a single judge. And they say, well, what does that mean? That's in 132, 28 U.S.C. 132. It says, should be noticed, it is fundamental that a district judge has no judicial power individually. His judicial power is exercised as a representative of the court. Jurisdiction is lodged in a court, not in a person. The judge exercising the jurisdiction acts for the court. He's acting on behalf of a court. It's not a government. And then it goes on further. The judge may exercise jurisdiction is subject absolutely to the control of Congress. And that's a Supreme Court case. So what we're doing, the judge is acting for the court. It's legislative. And the court is controlled by Congress.
They're just an extension of Congress at that point.
It's an administrative court, and Congress is in total control, and the judge is acting on behalf of Congress. They print this stuff now. This is in two cases. Is that shocking? It is to me when I found it. And you know what? The Federal Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, you didn't find those cases soon enough, so we're not going to use them.
No, it don't work like that. It has to do with the argument. You can't raise a new argument, but you can certainly use a higher level case or another case that supports your argument that you're already made and are still trying to argue.
Absolutely. But they couldn't go there because this lines it out. It is an Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9, legislative court. The judge represents the court, not a government. It's rigged. And they print it. And that court is under the control of Congress. Absolutely under the control of Congress. It's subject absolutely to the control of Congress. Dobb McDowell versus the United States.
Yeah. Well, part of me says I could see where they could have a separate administrative court system that deals with, you know, like federal agencies and maybe corporations doing business with the government or something like that. But as far as you and me, flesh and blood, human being that is not under that jurisdiction, we shouldn't even be in that court.
I've tried that, and that's what I was putting. One thing I've learned, put stuff in quotation marks. Judicial power of the United States. They can't touch it. District Court of the United States. They won't go there. Put it in quotation marks. We won't talk about it. We just won't talk about it. It never happened. It's like the Democrats and the election fraud. It never happened. Nothing to see here.
Yeah, move along.
So we're
like Sergeant Schultz.
We're headed to the Supreme Court of the United States here, and we'll see what that's about. But we have to stop and forget what we think we know that's so that's not. If this is an administrative court, because they do talk about regulations. These two cases, one of them is United States versus Roberts, and it's 618 F as in Frank 2D 530. 618 F 2D 530. Ninth Circuit case, 1980. That's one of the cases.
What was the name of the case, Roberts?
I got to go back here and look and see here again, just because I was moving up to the other one here. United States versus Roberts.
Okay, U.S. versus Roberts.
Yes, 618 F2D 530.
Got it.
Okay, the other case that talks about this that you use in conjunction with this is Eastern Metals Corporation versus Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N. And that's 191 F period S-U-P-P. That means it's a United States District Court case, not a district court. Anyway, it's 198 F period S-U-P-P 245.
The federal supplement.
Yeah, federal supplement. That's a 1960 case out of New York.
1960, okay.
Yep. They don't want this out. Why? Because the bottom line is what we've been trying to say, because in the Court of Claims, I've been in all the courts that the federales have now. I've been in the Court of Claims, which actually the Court of Claims was a constitutional court from 1952 to 1983, and then they changed it. And they come up with the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which was supposed to be decisions everywhere, but it's not an Article III court. They put it in there. Their decisions were good everywhere. They were quoting the IRS. 2 years later, they changed the code. It went away. It was a con. And it's not an Article III court. But the Federal Court of Claims, the United States Federal Court of Claims, was a constitutional court. They actually said it's an Article III court from 1952 to 1983. There are none now. And there
except
are no constitutional courts in the several states because there's no elections for any state officers. You can't have constitutional courts if there's no elections for any public officers. They don't exist. They've printed.
Amazing.
So the question becomes, if I'm fighting an administrative court, I said, okay, Ralph, back up for what I think I know is so. If I'm going to fight in an administrative court, what do I want to use? I want to use what that administrative court is using, don't I? That make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the other thing too is if that administrative court doesn't have jurisdiction over me, I want to dismiss it right up front. You know, if they're trying to drag me into court, I want to say, well, do you have the authority and jurisdiction to be pulling me into court?
They don't want to talk about it. I fought several of them like this, and they just try to roll over. So what I finally decided to look at said, you know, if I'm this administrative court is as foreign to our what we think is going on as going into France. So I'm going to look and see what France is using. I'm going to see what the administrative courts use. It's all under the Federal Register Act of 1935 and the Administrative Procedures Act of 1946, because they actually put those acts in the Federal Register.
Well,
and more importantly, back out here to the music. We'll be back in a minute.
Yeah, we still have Chris in Vegas. I hope you're standing by, Chris.
Oh, I didn't see that.
We'll be back after these messages.
By going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed the newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
The newspaper? Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, a majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper does not give out the important attention on what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Is your property a financial burden and causing you grief? Have you tried to sell but can't find buyers? Or are you just too busy to sell your property? Don't worry. We have the right solution for you. We buy properties as is, with cash, close in 30 days, and pay all closing costs. Our service is ideal for property owners who are in pre-foreclosure, have high-end repair costs, experiencing financial hardship, going through costly divorces, are relocating, need cash for retirement, suffering family loss, or have tax liens. Whatever your situation may be, we can help you sell your property and get the money you need. If you own a single-family home or multiple family units, call us for a free consultation at 888-910-1037. That's 888-910-1037. Or visit our website at cashingproperty.com. That's cashingproperty.com. Sell your property fast and leave all your worries behind.
Extendivite 7 herb formulation is approved to help maintain cardiovascular health and help lower blood lipid levels in adults. Extendivite is made from hawthorn, garlic, valerian, cayenne, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, and milk thistle. The herbs in Extendivite have been chosen for their ability to help with overall health. Many people have reported improved energy and stamina in just a few months. If you think you could feel just a little bit better, then Extendivite may just be for you. Extendivite is an all-natural supplement. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a two-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Okay, well, we're back here. Let's go to Chris and answer, take you, and then we'll proceed forward here. Got a question or comment?
Well, a couple of things here. I'm having to pull off the road so I don't disturb you guys with the noises, but this is just Chris. Although I'm near Las Vegas, I'm actually from Oklahoma City originally. And I have a case pendant there. I don't have the number with me because I'm out on the road, but it cites the McGirt case that Mark from Oklahoma spoke of earlier because it's dependent on the private grants of land made patent from Grover Cleveland from 1893, granting that land in particular, comes from Louisiana Purchase. And I have a case there pendant in the federal court regarding that private grants of land made patent and some thefts of them by the state of Oklahoma, the county, the sheriff, the sales agent for the sheriff, the tax collector and stuff, who have overlaid and tried to aggregate and assimilate the lands of Oklahoma that do not belong within there because those private grants of land made patent create an island status within the corporate state they lay coterminently within, placing them without the corporate state's jurisdiction and under absolute exclusive federally protected jurisdiction explicitly.
Okay. I don't know where it's going. I mean, I don't have an answer.
No. I will text you the number of the case later on. But this is a battle I fought before down in Arizona in Yavapai County and got a sub silentio decision down there. We've talked about that. I can't even find that case anymore. They made it buried so deeply, so I can't prove it except for the fact that they paved 11 miles of previously unpaved land to say they were sorry. They got caught being criminals and trying to assert
federal
jurisdiction
state.
Over lands they didn't know.
Federal or state?
Say again?
Federal. State.
Okay. So, remember, before the states were created, it was all federal territorial lands that existed. This is what happened in the McGirt case, I think, and also because the grant of land-made patent from Grover Cleveland came from 1893, and Oklahoma didn't become a state until 1907.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know your argument without looking at it and researching it, so I don't really have a comment.
That's all right. The other aspect that you were touching on that I'm pretty studied on also is this, what I would term obfuscation by equivocation. When we look up equivocation, we find that is something that non-Christians use to take advantage of Christians. And that's the word craft that the attorneys practice pretty prolifically. And this is where the U.S. citizen, although we're told that the Jus Civilis, the city law of Rome rights that were created under the pretext of the 14th Amendment, supposedly protecting everybody, I think those are really just privileges coming from the power of Congress, but they pose them as rights to confuse and discombobulate us like they
things that I would stop you right here. First, the U.S. citizen is different citizen of the United States. And the citizen of the United States is strictly civil rights. That's the first act, 14, stat 23. And that's the issue that I was just talking about here, is that the civil rights acts, you have no political rights. You have no inalienable rights, the laws of nature. You're affectional,
exactly.
Your affection created by Congress.
You're exactly right. And those small S state citizens, those are really foreign to Corp U.S. and the D.C. status. Of course, they've used several different scams like the zip code and other aspects to spread their federal jurisdiction secretly throughout the lands by volunteerism. And when you use the zip code and other aspects of the two-letter designation, you're incorporating D.C.'s federal jurisdiction throughout those places where those
all of these things, we're getting way off of point here, but you're covering so much territory. The bottom line is all of these issues are means to get us to submit unknowingly to called implied in law contracts. And that's where we want some benefit. We want something. We're going to admit something. It's like admissions. I admit that I am this, and they don't have to admit to anything. And there's nothing that they have to do on the other side. This is your Form 1040s, all of this stuff. And by the way, I do have somebody that did a W-4 that held for a whole year on withholding, and they just started taking out money again out of a military retirement, so he's got to submit a W-4 for 2021, the one where you actually modify an implied in law contract. They quit taking money out for a whole year. Okay?
Well, that's very good, and I certainly appreciate that. I would suggest that the Title 8 U.S.C. Section 1101, parenthetical A, parenthetical 22 parenthetical capital B versus capital A on the last one, is the U.S. national, the non-citizen U.S. national specifically, that's set forth in the Immigration Naturalization Act. And that is the only ones that are the small S state citizens that used to be the resident aliens or the foreign aliens that lived without in the small S states.
Well, what
that,
that, what that is what you quoted. There is USA 1101A, 22, A and B. A is a citizen of the United States. B is or you owe permanent allegiance, but you're not a citizen of the United States. That's us. And that's
exactly.
Called National of the United States, and that is in your passport, by the way.
In fact, I have one that has 3 stars. I have a friend that has 5 stars on his travel pass card, and that is the ones that gives you aspects of diplomatic immunity because they're administered by the Secretary of State's Bureau of Consular Affairs exclusively.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to get back
on
what I'm trying to finish up here.
Okay.
You got a comment, Mark? I guess not. I'm going to get back on finishing up on my subject. Was that okay?
Sounds Chris? Good. I'm back.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah.
This is so critical because in the Federal Register Act, this is how I exposed the tax court. I wanted to take judicial notice. If you don't take judicial notice, what are you using as a rule of law? Well, what are you using? It's like saying, okay, I'm in the Bible, but I can't use the Ten Commandments. Well, wait a minute. Why would I be in the Bible if I don't use the Ten Commandments? It's illogical. The Federal Register Act is published several times, and it's in 1935. And it says, federal agency or agency means President of the United States, and it also includes agency. Federal, this is where the executive orders come from. And it's got, it also says, there shall be published in the Federal Register stuff that has general applicability and legal effect. Okay? And it also says, get down here, stuff, no document required under 5A, which is general applicability and legal effect, to be published in the Federal Register shall be valid against any person who has not had actual knowledge of it. So what are we saying? First of all, agencies have to publish in the Federal Register if it has legal applicability, general applicability, and legal effect. That's a mandate. Okay? And they say if it's not published there, it doesn't have any effect. And here's the killer. The contents of the Federal Register shall be judicially noticed without prejudice to any other mode of citation. May be cited by volume and page number. So what? Why is this all important? We are fighting agencies. We're in the administrative world. And they have to, if they're going to touch you or me, they have to put it in the Federal Register. That's a mandate. And if it's not in there, they can't use it. And they have to take judicial notice of it. That's important because in the administrative world, that's all they have to take judicial notice of. Then along, after 1937, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was losing control of these agencies and he had research done, 300 or 400, and they come up with a headless fourth branch of government, which is what they are. He said there are many governments. So in 1946, first of all, it's mandated that the only thing that agencies can do, the only authority is, if it's going to touch you or me, it's got to be in the Federal Register. You can't tell by looking at the CFR number, Code of Federal Regulation, because they have many Federal Registers under them. They had to go step, the next step. They have to say, it has a force and effect of law. It has to be a substantive regulation. And how do you tell that? The only way, which is ridiculous. Imagine if we got law, Congress is up there doing their nonsense and they pass it and it's signed by the president. Do we have to go in and check all this nonsense out? Of course not. It's not laws of the United States. But if they voted for it in the House, they voted for it in the Senate, and the president signs it, we take it as true. We don't have to go in and check it, make sure they voted it and all this other nonsense. They made it very, very complicated because they, number one, if it has legal, general applicability, legal effect, it's got to be in the Federal Register. And number two, they have to take judicial notice of it. And if it's not in the Federal Register, they can't use it against us. And then the APA comes along and they said, anything that Congress is doing has no application to the citizens, they're talking about citizens of the United States, unless it's published in, there's a regulation. They print this now. But the question becomes, okay, so number one, it's got to be in the Federal Register. It's got general applicability, legal effect. They got to judicially notice it. So the question becomes, how do I know if it has a force and effect of law? Because they publish housekeeping regulations that are nonsense, they only apply to regulation to them. They publish interpretive regs where the agency is interpreting the statutes, with who the hell cares? That's for their own internal nonsense. The only one we have to be concerned with, and it's got to say 5 USC 553. That's called the formal way of doing it. They have to say it in a proposed rule and a final rule. There's two stages, and we are supposed to have the ability to comment on it. Whoopee-doo. How many people know that? Oh, but they never do those. So what else do they do? I've got to bring this up because I never can remember the other part of this. What they do is called the informal. And they will... Before, there's the formal. It's got to be there, 553. There's either the formal or the informal. And if there's nothing there, it's smoke. They can't just get around and just say, well, I'm not going to do that. No, that's not the way it works. You have to either have it in there, or it's got to say it in the proposed, and it's got to say it in the final. There is no getting around it. And that's a fact. And the other one here, I got to kind of got to find this here. In the 1960s, it's in the 1946 Senate report, which is an amazing document. They put it out to explain everything about the Administrative Procedures Act. It explains how evidence is supposed to work. It explains what these words mean. I mean, it's all right there. It's like a how-to book. And this is when I found out about what I was missing. Because let me bring it up here. I'll get to it in just a second here. Here we go. Here is what they do. Let me see here. Let me do M-E-R-G-E-N. And what they do is they say it's not in the public interest. That's one of the things that they do. They say it's unnecessary. And they also say it's impractical. So it's impractical, unnecessary, and not in the public interest. They'll have all three of them, or one or two or three. What I didn't understand until I saw this, it's called the escape clause. It's mandates. They cannot use those unless they declare in what the fact and the law is for the emergency. They never disclose it. They will say, oh, it's impractical, it's unnecessary, and it's contrary to the public interest. They never state the emergency, which says it's mandated to be done. But it gets worse. When they are using the informal, not the formal. They'll never do a formal. Because I've never seen one yet that has a force and effect of law. That's a holding Chrysler v. Brown, 1979. Here's the scary part of this whole thing. Impractical means a situation due and required by the execution of the agency functions would be unavoidably prevented by its undertaking public rulemaking procedures. In other words, if we did the impractical, the purpose is because we could stop it from being made. You say, wait a minute, is this the way this works? That would impede them, their rulemaking. That's what summed up impractical, unnecessary, and public interest. It's because we would impede and stop them making rules. Is that the way our republic works? I don't think so. So the real key to this whole thing is you get around, you have to go to the Federal Register publications. If it has a part 301 like in the IRS or part 601, you can throw it out because automatically it's junk. But if it's other ones, you can't tell. You must go to the Federal Register, and you must quote the Federal Register if you're attacking the judicial or the agency, because that's the only thing the administrative court looks at, because it's their law. It's just that simple. It's their law. They have to judicially notice it. And the APA, when you tie that in, they're done. But I can't seem to get this concept across. Agencies only can make regulations in the Federal Register that are judicially noticed. That's a fact. So that's the only thing you can use against them that's judicially noticed, is what's in the Federal Register. They can't make statutes. Congress can't make regulations. Congress can't do regulations. Agencies can't use statutes. So what do? You get a letter from the IRS, so what do? They quote statutes. It's irrelevant. You've lost before you even start, or any agency. The agencies pay no attention to statutes. They just use it as a cover. They caught us. And we go chasing our tail after the statute. It's irrelevant. You're going to lose. And people keep doing the same thing. I go look at these cases, and they keep doing the same thing over and over and over, expecting a different result. And the courts just keep screwing them. They never tell them why. If you're going to go after an agency, the only thing, if it's going to have general applicability and legal effect, it's got to be in the Federal Register. And then there's a certain process if it's going to have the forced effect of law. And if it's not in the Federal Register, and if it's not in compliance with the APA, 553 B, C, and D, it's smoke. That's the only way to fight them. What say ye, Mark? Hello?
Well, yes, I agree, Ralph. I apologize. I had my microphone on mute there for a second. But, I totally agree with you. Instead of getting drugged through a court that you shouldn't be in, this is a great opportunity to be making a challenge right up front. And it's crazy that, we've just been so brainwashed into thinking we're a U.S. citizen and don't even know what the implications are and what even qualifies to be a U.S. citizen. And most people now for many years have, right from birth, their parents just signed them up as a U.S. citizen, whether they really were or not.
Citizen of the United States. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, we've had parents and government, hospitals and parents have been signing up people on their birth certificates, and they've been misclassified as far as their citizenship status.
This is why when you come across the border, they say, oh, we have anchor babies, because a citizen of the United States, Congress, and say, oh, yeah, we'll give you civil rights. You got no political rights, folks, because to be naturalized, you got to come in as a citizen of the United States of America. Takes 5 years. Congress can't make that. They can't do that. They can say you're a citizen of the United States. I got some questions I want to ask our senators and representatives since we get the home page up and going. I get a couple cases out of the way. I want to answer. Does a citizen of the United States have political rights? Yes or no? Does he have the right of the elective franchise? Yes or no? Because in the District of Columbia, a qualified elector, which is the highest status you can get in voting, you've got nothing. In the several states. The Supreme Court said so. So why would I want to do that? Makes no sense. Of course, what they did is, in 1939, they did the Public Salary Act, and the state says, we'll do this little con. We'll allow you to tax us, and the feds, okay, we'll go back and forth. We'll do a handshake. Then in 1940, they did the Buck Act. We're going to deem everybody to be a citizen of the United States. How do they get us to do that? Well, I go down to register to vote. I sign up for it. I do not want my political rights. I signed up Social Security. I signed up, but they, each one of them is a separate act. Bank accounts, everything. Driver's licenses go straight to the National National Voter Registration Act of 1993. Your state plans, every state has one. They're all code of federal regulations. They're all federal register. They're all federal. There's nothing in the state plans about the abortions, about the adoptions, about child custody, driver's licenses. All that is in there. And they have what's called cooperative agreements. The judge, the court, is in bed with the child slavers, the executive, the CSSD, and the judge is audited for the amount of money he makes. And I have a contract. I got to get it updated. I thought we had separation of powers. No. In that world, we don't. In the administrative world, there is no separation of powers. They use the constitutional side to say, oh, you don't have any standing, you don't have this, to keep us thinking, well, we must be doing something wrong. Nobody will talk about the Citizen of the United States stuff.
So, Ralph, are you saying that a judge in a like a child custody or a divorce case, they have a financial interest in the outcome of that?
The court does. The court does. The judge is audited for the amount of money he makes for the court. Wow. And they all share in it.
Well, if they're all sharing in it, then it would seem like to be a huge conflict of interest.
It is. When I first found about it, it was Alice Brown in Alaska. We lost because I was researching all this stuff out. And then when she had another out of wedlock child in Montana, a little boy, we brought this up. They gave her a check for $20,000 and told her to get the hell out of Montana.
Did she get to take her child with her?
Oh, yeah. And then what they did in the court case, which I got, they said there was a settlement. And that's it. They don't ever tell you what's going on. I happen to know because she gave me a little bit of money for keeping her child. Because I said, hey, y'all want to fight this out? Let's get this cooperative agreement. Let's get it out in the open. Come on. They didn't want to do that. They just paid her off and said, get the hell out of Montana. She did. She went to California. Actually, she lived in Old Mexico for quite a while because she was scared spitless of these states.
I bet.
But the state plan, this started in 1935. Everything in there is a code of federal regulation. There's nothing to do with your state. And if you go look at the CFR, the Federal Register, they say that the executive and all these people all got to have cooperative agreements. They all signed up together to make money. But boy, they don't want to cough those up in your states, I guarantee you. You got to search, we ain't got those. Well, it says right here, you got it. I got the state plan, Bubba. Tell me it ain't so.
Well, this is why I like to really encourage people to come join our discussion group. Go to AlaskaMinuteman.com. And look at the red button to join our discussion group. Get signed up. We've got some good things happening. A lot of people have already signed up. So come out and join us. That's AlaskaMinuteman.com.
And send me an IRS at AlaskaMinuteman and donate $250 per year. If you can, I'll still add you.
All right. Well, good night, everybody.
Okay. Well, God willing, we will see you next Sunday.
Years ago, when warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen planned to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.